This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town. Your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose, filling in for Rochelle Hunt.
How important is basic healthcare to you this election, and how accessible is it? Getting in to see a GP or a dentist can be hard and costly. There are election commitments from both Labor and the Coalition to encourage more bulk billing by doctors. But what about dental care? Good morning, Kirsten Diprose here with you for the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria. This is my final day filling in for Rochelle Hunt. Thank you for having me. Now, a new survey of nearly 450 Australian dental practitioners has found that two-thirds support the expansion of Medicare to include more dental services, with many reporting that their patients are increasingly delaying treatment due to the cost. Also, one-third of patients experience difficulty paying for preventative care, and more than 40% of them for general dental treatment. So in this cost of living election, are we forgetting our teeth?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Also coming up, we'll be joined by a regional GP about bulk billing, with another survey out this morning showing only a fraction of doctors believe they will be able to bulk bill more patients. That's despite those commitments by Labor and the Coalition to incentivise bulk billing. So very much a focus on our basic healthcare this morning. How accessible are GPs and dental services in terms of costs and just the ability to get in? And how important is this to you right now as an election issue? Joining us now is Matt Hopcraft. He's the Associate Professor at Melbourne University Dental School. Hi, Matt. Now, you're one of the lead researchers behind this work, this new research, which will be published in the Australian Dental Journal. Welcome to The Conversation Hour.
Thanks for having me, Kirsten.
So before we dive into the results of this survey of dentists, why did you do this survey in the first place?
Yeah, it's a good question. And there's been a lot of advocacy around this idea that we need to improve access to dental care for a long time. And, you know, if we go back to the very history of Medicare, when Medicare was first introduced 50 years ago, there was thought to including dentistry in there, but the profession was strongly opposed to it. There was a whole lot of political reasons. And so the mouth has just kind of been left out of the body ever since. We had a couple of years ago, the Senate Select Committee had a big inquiry into access to dental services, recognising that so many people, as you've said, were putting off going, were finding it unaffordable, were having challenges. And I was one of the people who gave evidence at that Senate Committee, and they heard a lot of stories of the challenges that people are experiencing, particularly as cost of living pressures are biting. And so I just wanted to find out, you know, we know that there's support, there's really strong support amongst the community to do this. I really wanted to know, you know, what does the profession think? What are the views of the people at the coalface who would have to implement this? And, you know, it was really pleasing to see that there was a really high proportion who said, yeah, they do support this idea now that we actually start including more dental services into Medicare.
Why was it opposed historically by people in the profession?
Look, it's hard to, you know, we're talking 50 years ago, and it's hard to sort of really dig into that. I think that there were certainly concerns about the cost of doing that, and those concerns, we still hear those concerns today. I think that there was some concern about loss of autonomy. Dentistry's long been a profession that really sort of fiercely protects their autonomy. It's a profession that's strongly private practice based, and that's one of the problems that we're now seeing with people having access to care. And I think, you know, probably a little bit of, you know, the unknown aspect of it as well.
Are dentists feeling left out of this current healthcare debate? You know, we've seen Labor and the Coalition sort of matching each other on various promises around healthcare, and the big one is around incentivising more GPs to bulk bill. What about dental care? Has that really gained much traction? We hear the reoccurring conversation about dental being on Medicare, but this election, it's been rather quiet when it comes to oral care.
Yeah, and this is a part of our ongoing problem, is that, you know, the mouth has been left out of the body, and we you know, we hear the Greens talking about it, and that's really good that they've got a plan to do something. It was really disappointing to hear, I think, both the Health Minister, Mark Butler, yesterday, and the Shadow Health Minister, Anne Rustin, at the National Press Club, when they were asked a question about dental care. You know, Mark Butler said, well, it's not in their priority to do anything now because he wants to focus on GP visits and bulk billing. And that's an important issue. But one of the things that, you know, we're sort of failing to recognise is that a lot of people end up at the GP or end up at the hospital with a dental problem because they can't afford to see a dentist. So there's actually kind of a cost saving there by bringing dentistry into Medicare. And Anne Rustin said, you know, they want to focus on primary care, which just, you know, kind of ignores the fact that dental care is part of primary care. And so I think both the major parties there are really missing an opportunity to improve the health, the well-being, and improve, you know, economic productivity, because we know that poor oral health has such wide-ranging effects across the community.
Just some of the text messages. Kirsten, I had to access early super for degenerative dental work, says Dax. Another text says, not just dental, pathology and radiology, where the gaps between Medicare rebate and invoice total are substantial. And bulk billing will certainly help with affordability, but what about availability? Maybe more needs to be done to support GPs too. I have major chronic health issues and a wonderful GP who bulk bills me, but it can be 6 to 8 weeks wait for a more routine appointment. So again, we are talking to a GP after you, in fact, but it all has that knock-on effect from the dental side of things too, because then you do end up in emergency care or in the GP when something goes wrong if you're not looking after your teeth.
That's right, Kirsten. We know that poor oral health is the leading cause of preventable hospitalisations in Australia, so it's costing the economy about $1.6 billion. People are going to their GP, so they're tying up that valuable GP resource because they can't afford to go to a dentist. They often get prescribed antibiotics, which doesn't fix the problem, and that causes a whole lot of other issues. So, you know, we think, as with all of these issues, you know, the fundamental problem is, let's fix access to dental care. Let's put some funding into bringing some, you know, dental services into Medicare. It's a system that we know works well. We've got a good system for children. You know, the child dental benefit schedule is working well. So we've got a model that we can operate on. And like I say, you know, we've got now across the profession large support for doing this now.
Matt Hopcraft is with us, Associate Professor at the Melbourne University Dental School. And Dax is actually on the line now. Hi, Dax. You mentioned that you had to access your super for some dental work.
Yeah, I had to get some early access to super for some degenerative dental that I had some issues with, a lot of issues with. And I did all the right things growing up. Like, my family didn't have soft drinks. We weren't big as sweet tooth, and we didn't really do any of that things, but it was just a degenerative thing. And I started losing a lot of my teeth around about 35. And it got to a point where eating was extremely difficult. Couldn't really eat very, very much foods. It was mostly just soft foods. So, yeah, I got to the point when I was 50 and then had to access early super for hardship.
How much did it cost, if you don't mind? You don't have to answer that if you don't want to.
I don't really want to say, but it was a lot.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, having to access your super, you know, again, puts you behind in the future potentially. You know, I'm sure a Medicare rebate would have helped.
Absolutely, it would have helped. I think getting dental on some kind of Medicare scheme, even if it's, you know, limited, but just something, you know, something would be helpful for a lot of people for preventative dental work, rather than sort of going through what I had to go through and essentially getting half my teeth removed and replaced. So,
Yeah. Dax, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Have a good day.
Thank you. Matt, I mean, you know, hearing that story, how common is it for people to need, you know, really extensive work? And, I mean, Dax was talking there, he wasn't doing the wrong thing. You can be unlucky genetically, can't you, in terms of your teeth?
You know, Dax's stories, it's just really heartbreaking to hear, and we hear it over and over again. Yes, there's a genetic component. Yes, there are a whole lot of other factors that kind of play into this. I think one of our challenges is that we're often fighting against this perception that poor oral health is purely a consequence of bad choices that people make, and we know that it's much more complicated than that. I think the point that Dax really highlights too, and one of the things that I'm really concerned about, is we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years the number of people accessing their superannuation has just skyrocketed. So in the last financial year, $500 million of the $1 billion that was taken out of super early was for dental treatment. So the dental treatment is now, you know, half of the amount that's been taken out. People are taking out between $20,000 and $40,000 of their super to fund their dental treatment, and that the long-term consequences for people is, you know, really kind of dire, and we shouldn't be forcing people to have to raid their superannuation, have to raid their retirement fund to access basic essential dental care. It's just not what we should be doing in a modern society.
So this research of yours, Matt Hopcroft, has found that patients are increasingly delaying treatment due to cost. And is that across the board, so for preventative as well as general dental treatment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even for the basics, you know, going in for a checkup and for preventive care, large numbers of dentists were saying that their patients were either putting off, were having difficulty paying, you know, around about a third for paying for preventive care, and nearly half that had delayed recommended dental treatment, so treatment that they needed, or were choosing less than ideal treatment because the cost was just too much for them. And that they all said, you know, that had been increasing significantly over the past 12 months.
Let's go to our calls, and Charles is in Yarrawonga. Hi, Charles.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to say?
Well, I can't understand why it isn't a part of Medicare. Now, I guess by the time I was 18, which was 50-odd years ago, I had already partial dentures because of poor oral hygiene, decided that whatever happens from that point on, that the children that I have will have good dental care. And I once I was listening to your radio, I had a quick think about how much I spent for the five children, and it came to around $70,000 by the time you get preventative care, wisdom teeth extractions, teeth straightening, and just basic what I'd call basic dental health for the five kids over that time.
Wow.
Now that they're adults, they can look after themselves, of course, but it makes no sense that it's not part of Medicare.
And it is such an important thing, and you've obviously had that experience. You know, it's your smile. It's your, you know, it's your what you put out to the world.
Yeah,
it's important.
Exactly. Exactly. But it makes no sense that it's not part of Medicare. It's our health.
Yeah. Charles, thank you so much for calling in. Matt, there is a little bit of relief for children, isn't there? I have two kids, and I know that there are sometimes you can access a free checkup here and there, but I know I'm certainly out of pocket most of the time paying for them. But I think there's a little bit more for children.
There's good schemes for children, and so our public dental services around the country will usually provide free care to children up to the age of 12 and potentially up to the age of 17, depending on the state. But our public dental services are really under-resourced and underfunded, and so that makes it really hard to provide that comprehensive care to all children. And then there is the child dental benefit schedule, which is available to about half of the kids, so people with family tax benefit A, and that funds up to $1,100 over 2 years, and they can access that in the public sector or the private sector. So that's a much better scheme that provides a lot more general care for people. There's still some areas of that we need to fix. But certainly, you know, and one really strong message, obviously, particularly around Easter time when people have probably been eating a little bit too much of the chocolate, is really, you know, concentrating on making sure that we're getting our kids off for regular care. Regular preventive checks for everyone is so, so important.
Matt, are there any sort of horror stories that have come up through this conversation you've had with, you know, 450 dental practitioners across the country where patients really have been left in a dire situation? And I know that this was a long time ago, but my own grandmother had her teeth pulled, all of them, in her 20s. And my mum always tells a story of remembering her, you know, on the couch in pain. And, you know, that was dentistry back in the day, a long time ago now. But, you know, do we find those cases where people really have been left in a bad situation?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think Dax, you know, kind of highlighted that with his story about having things get to a stage where he eventually had to raid his super to fix things up. The Senate inquiry heard that, I think they had something like 17,000 responses to a public survey, and people were writing in with those same sorts of stories about how they couldn't afford care. And one of the things we know, unfortunately, with our oral health is that if we put off regular care, we put off that preventive care, small problems can become big problems very, very quickly. And so one of the consequences of not funding that preventive care, those regular checkups, is that things get much, much worse, to a stage where then people are having to have quite extreme treatment, losing teeth, losing large numbers of teeth. And then, you know, that impact that it has on their well-being, their ability to smile, to find a job, to chew, their nutrition, their general health. It's such a wide problem that has such a wide impact. And I think, like Charles said, it makes no sense that it's not, you know, currently covered under Medicare.
And the text line thoroughly agrees with that sentiment. A lot of people texting in saying it should be under Medicare. Michelle in Gippsland says, I'm considering trading my current vehicle for an older car so that I can pay for necessary dental treatment. A couple of texts as well saying, you know, that dental care has been a luxury item for too long, and if the Greens are advocating for financial assistance for this, I'm voting for them. Is it just the Greens politically that are focusing on dental care coming under Medicare?
The Greens have certainly been a very strong supporter of doing this, but I know that there are a few independents. I saw recently Monique Ryan, who'd made light of someone vandalising one of her posters and blacking out one of her teeth, using that as an opportunity to say, actually, now's the time to bring dentistry into Medicare. I think some of the other independents are certainly supporting that that idea as well. And I'd really strongly encourage people, as they're thinking about voting in this election, contacting their candidates. You know, I'm running a website, Give Medicare Teeth, to find their candidates, ask them that question and say, you know, is this something that you think is important? Because as you said, your switchboard is lighting up. The overwhelming majority of people out there say that we really should be doing this, and it's really disappointing then that we have a health minister, we have a shadow health minister who are saying, we're probably not going to take action on this in the next 3 years of Parliament. We don't think this is a priority. When all of the constituents are saying, actually, this is a priority, this is causing people so many problems. So I think there's potentially an opportunity with a minority government, with a strong crossbench, that maybe that's the thing that will get this over the line in the next term of Parliament.
Matt Hopcraft, it sounds like your work is not over yet, but thank you so much for joining us. Associate Professor at the Melbourne University Dental School there. You are listening to The Conversation Hour. My name's Kirsten Diprose. I'm filling in for Rochelle Hunt. Coming up in a moment, how do we make healthcare more accessible from a GP perspective? We'll be diving into bulk billing in just a moment.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
You're listening to The Conversation Hour. Kirsten Diprose here, filling in for Rochelle Hunt. Is more bulk billing the panacea we've all been hoping for, especially in rural and regional Victoria, where wait times to just get into a GP can be 2, 3, 4 weeks, even longer? Now, this has been a very interesting topic of conversation this morning, with surveys by ABC News and the Royal Australian College of GPs finding that only a fraction of doctors believe they will be able to bulk bill more patients. Now, of course, both Labor and the Coalition have committed to an $8.5 billion package incentivising doctors to bulk bill all patients. Dr. Belinda Bell is a GP based in Warrnambool and is one of those bulk billing doctors. Welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Hi, Kristen. Nice to be here.
Look, it's great to see bipartisan commitment on such an important issue in healthcare. On the ground, though, is it going to make much of a difference?
Look, I think you've hit the nail on the head when you mentioned that it takes 3 to 4 weeks to even get in to see a doctor. I think that there's two elements here. I mean, yes, the bulk billing incentive will make a difference to people in a rural, remote areas where concessional rates are quite high. But saying that, you can access bulk billing incentives, but some of the new package that they're promising, it's a loophole you have to jump through to be able to access that. So it's not just a matter of saying, oh, my doctor's not bulk billing me even though they've been promised all these things. It's that the whole practice needs to be The whole practice has to be bulk billing in order to access that. Now, that's complex on its own. You've got multiple different personalities. You've got independent practitioners that all have different ways of practicing. So one person decides they want a private bill out of 12 doctors in a practice and you're not going to get that incentive. So that's complex in that way.
So it's not supportive of mixed operations then, is that what you're saying?
No, it's really not. If we were able to bulk bill whoever we like, so people that didn't have concession cards, but there wasn't that overarching everyone and every eligible item must be bulk billed, I think that would make it more of a realistic option for us, because of those complexities, you're right. I also think that it's not just the incentives and throwing money at it that's the answer. I think that we need more GPs. That's the issue. You can pay people as well as you want, but there's only so many hours in a day. There's only so much someone can do, and it's just as much of an access issue as it is a finance issue.
And I mean, you're based in Warrnambool, which is where I am right now as well. Yep. And I mean, it's incredibly hard to get to a doctor in Warrnambool and across the southwest. And I know many people who just get a GP appointment 4 weeks in advance. You know, it's just in case you or someone in your family needs it.
Yeah.
Like, we're almost. It's like the pre-GPing. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of this.
Yeah, no, definitely. I've even gotten to the point where I've been recommending it to some of my patients because I know that they have complex care needs and there are so many hours in a day that you can service people, and having that safeguard, you're safeguarding yourself as well as the patient. I think that with the overall bulk billing everyone idea also causes some hesitancy on our part, because I know, at least in personal experience and with colleagues, that when people contribute something to their healthcare, they're more likely to engage in that healthcare and they're not likely to abuse the service. Now, if something was readily available, how the government is brooking it as free healthcare, I think that people would make appointments for unnecessary visits. And then that, again, causes an issue with access to those that truly need it. It'll be saturated with things that people may have managed on their own otherwise. and may have resolved really easily, or may have been able to manage with help from a pharmacist or some general advice or a public health education. I just don't think it's going to ease the pressure on the GP workforce, which is something that they need to look at too.
1300 222 774. How do we make our basic healthcare services more accessible? Dr. Belinda Bell is with us, a GP based in Warrnambool. Belinda, you know, you've said we need more GPs. That's one area. Yes. What about specialists, particularly in rural and regional areas? You just don't have those specialists and those public specialists.
Yeah, it's really difficult. I think there's definitely a bottleneck with the training, even in the cities, and that's where most of the specialty training happens. I mean, part of the reason why I didn't go down the any other specialty program is because I couldn't do that in a rural area or a remote area. I think the ability to have people do specialty programs in rural areas would possibly entice people to be able to stay in those areas. I think having access to that's important. I know that one of our local dermatologists, for instance, had to find funding to be able to fund a registrar to train with them to provide services. So they're having to scrounge up money themselves to be able to even get someone there. It's so multifactorial. It hurts my head. It does. but as something I wanted to point out that I think is important, when I was going through training, we never talked about funding, how people got paid in their different specialties, what you'd expect to get paid. It was a bit of a taboo thing. Medicare never got mentioned. We didn't talk about rebates. We didn't talk about the rules around that and how to navigate Medicare. It was kind of like you go to the hospital, you do your training there, and the medical administration looks after all that billing side of things. Whereas you go out to be an independent practitioner and you're kind of lost. So I think that because Medicare is so often hard to interpret, and some of the item numbers are just so stringent, that there's a fear of auditing and there's a fear of liability if you don't follow it to a T. And so people are more likely to feel safer privately billing.
But it's a really interesting point you make, Belinda, yeah. About, you know, doctors, if you've got your own practice, you've got a business as well, a small business, yeah. Effectively, and yeah. You're highly trained in being a doctor and knowing medicine, but not necessarily well trained in being a business person. You know, you bulk bill, don't you?
I do a majority. I've had to start private billing just for the viability of our practice, which goes against my grain. I prefer to bulk bill, but if I don't help out the practice by privately billing, I won't have a workplace to turn up to, and then people won't have a place to see a doctor.
Because this is an assumption that doctors make great money, but you're also running a business. Like, you've got to pay staff.
Yes, definitely. And then when we talk about free healthcare and the government saying everything will be, well, 9 out of 10 will be bulk billed, they don't talk about things like dressings, the cost of dressings, which can sometimes be up to $100 a dressing change. They don't take those things into account. And a lot of practices are having to pass on those costs to the patients and say, hey, we need to pay for this separately because of those overhead costs. We've got the staff, you've got the rent of the property, and often in metropolitan areas that's going to be more expensive and they're getting less of the bulk billing incentive. So that's complex in that way. Then you've got your registration, you've got your insurance, you've got your medical indemnity, you've got ongoing training, you've got your college fees. There's a whole lot of things. And if you're a female GP, you tend to see people for longer periods of time, or not even as a female GP, if you're doing more complex health issues like multimorbidities or mental health, then the bulk billing incentives don't reflect that increase in care. The longer the consult is, doesn't actually correlate with the bulk billing incentive. It's the same amount for no matter how long you spend with them. So it does promote six-minute medicine, which isn't necessarily great.
No, I don't think any patient, anyone wants a six-minute appointment with the GP in that kind of sense of just turning through them. Does the Medicare rebate need to be improved or made higher?
I feel like there needs education around what the Medicare rebate is and how it's essentially public health insurance. So if you don't have private health insurance, Medicare covers you. And so the rebate to the patient needs to be increased so that there's less out-of-pocket when it comes to seeing the doctor. So the doctor will essentially pay what they have to make things run. And then what has to happen is that the patient needs to be able to get more of that back. And that's where increasing Medicare rebate comes in. At the moment, with the increase in the bulk billing incentive, they're essentially putting more money in our pockets but not trying to encourage us to, I guess, ignore the fact that the Medicare rebate indexation has been ignored for up to a decade.
There are incentives, though, Dr. Belinda Bell, for rural retention, aren't there? Like, you get a loading if you are, the more remote or rural you are.
Yeah, yeah, we do. So it's based off something called the Modified Monash Model. And we do get a higher degree of bulk billing incentive the more rural you are. And there is a workforce incentive. Well, there's a practice and a doctor stream. So we do get money for being in locations to support us in those locations once a year. That has changed in recent years. But there is that, and you do get more the more rural you are. And again, that's something that you're not told about when you're going through training. So I think it's important for people in training to know their options.
Is it worthwhile being a rural doctor, like purely financially? I know you love it for, you know, the role that you get to play in the community, but financially, is it worth it?
I think it depends on who you're seeing, depends on the workload that you're doing. Yes, I think that it is. And you can have a very financially viable career at least in regional Australia, definitely. That's the only thing I can comment on.
So why don't we have more doctors then coming here, staying here?
Again, I think it's because of that education. I think they don't know. They hear all the bad. They don't see much of the good. I think there needs to be more exposure in training. It's tricky. There's going to be this grey area where we need more GPs to come in, and it's going to be rough for a little while, but then once we get more, it'll improve. They see the burnt out doctors that are currently holding up the system, and they go, oh God, do I want to do that? Some people are really passionate and go, yeah, get me in there, let's do this. But a lot don't.
Dr. Belinda Bell, we are out of time, but thank you so much for joining us on the Conversation Hour.
No worries, pleasure. Thanks, Kristen.
Dr. Belinda Bell there, a GP based in Warrnambool, and I can attest, if you are thinking about becoming a rural or regional GP, you will be the most loved person in the community, and people will do everything to make you stay. You are listening to ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Coming up, are you into motorcycling or are your kids? Getting the right protective clothing can be a game changer when it comes to reducing injury. So many texts when it comes to dental and doctors. This one, the unis need to start upselling and glamorising the role of GPs. They are an integral part of the health delivery system. Steve in Surry Hills says, I think the $8.5 billion will be better spent reducing the out-of-pocket fees fee rather than more bulk billing. My local has a gap of $50 on weekdays and $100 on weekends. If that was reduced to, say, $20 or $25, I would go when I should rather go than not going at all. That's interesting. How much would actually make a difference in your behaviour? And this one, GPs have such a complex job and the specialists seem to shove all the downstream care and monitoring to them. No wonder nobody wants to do it. Goes on to say how much specialists can charge. 1300 222 774. Keep those texts and calls coming, or you can text in on 0437 774 774. Now, we recently spoke on this program about motorcyclists and how they're overrepresented in road deaths. And we discussed what sorts of things need to be put in place to make them more safe, which is an area that often gets overlooked in these discussions. Motorcycle gear. And while the gear can't necessarily prevent a fatality, it can reduce injury. But how do we know what gear makes a difference? Well, to help us with that, we have Chris Hurren, a chief scientist at MotorCap, which is a body funded largely by New South Wales government, and associate professor in textile research at Deakin University. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Kirsten. Sorry to correct you to start off with. MotorCap's actually funded by every state in Australia ACC in New Zealand. So New South Wales is the governing body, but they're not the main funder. So
it's a lot of governments joining up.
Yes, correct. Fantastic. And it's the power of all the governments getting together to be able to provide information to riders. And as chief scientist and also the laboratory that does all the garment testing, we're here to give information so riders can make the right choice rather than going into a shop and being unaware of what they're going to buy. They can actually go in and say, well, I want this particular garment or this particular pair of gloves because they're going to be the right ones for me for the riding I do.
So what should people be looking for in their clothing, and what kind of prevention or, you know, coverage can it give you?
So what we do with MotorCap, and for those that don't know about it, it's a star rating system for motorcycle gear. So we're buying gear in stores, we test it, and then all the results are all free online for anyone to look at. It's not really easy to just walk into a store and say that's protective or that's not protective. Even myself, who's been working in this space for 8 years, occasionally I make mistakes and say I think that's really protective, and then when we test it, it's not. So MotorCap demystifies all that for you. You can come in onto the website, have a look and say, okay, I want a pair of protective denim jeans. There's over 100 on the website. You can say, wow, they're the ones I really want to be wearing. You can go into a store, try them on, make sure they feel and fit right, and then buy them and know that they're going to have the protection levels that you're after.
What are some of the injuries that can happen when you fall off your bike? I think that gravel is what makes me nervous. I have two young children, two boys who are into their dirt bikes, and it's the gravel that makes me worried.
So I have a son that rides as well, so I understand totally how it makes you worried, and I rode in this morning. The most likely injury that you're going to have when you crash a motorcycle is a soft tissue injury, and so that's going to be abrasion or bruising or that sort of nature of cuts, lacerations. So most of the clothing to start off with needs to have that abrasion protection. It's also got to have seams that hold together, because soft tissue injury can come because when you hit the ground, the clothing pops open at the seams, and that then instantly exposes your body to abrasion. So again, the gravel, and then impact. And so if you're riding around town where there's lots of gutters and posts and things like that, impact with that can be the next biggest cause of injury when you crash a motorcycle.
How important are protective jackets? You know, I think we see our motorbike riders looking very cool in their jackets, but what actually needs to be in them? And I know if you're sort of doing anything kind of remotely competitive, they often wear those plates. Do you need a plate or do you just need certain material?
So when you look at a garment, whether it's a jacket or whether it's a pants, what you're looking for is that abrasion resistance protection in the high risk areas. So for a jacket, that's the essentially the outer arm, so the elbow, from the wrist up to the elbow and essentially all the way up to the shoulder, because this is where we land and we slide the most. With pants, that's the knee, the sides, the legs and the bottom. And with gloves, it's the palms and the knuckles, because these are the bits that we're hitting the ground with and sliding on. You also need impact protection. So for pants, that's in the knees and the hips, and for jackets, that's in the elbows and the shoulders. Now, a lot of people think that armour needs to be hard. There's a lot of really, really good soft armour out there that's actually better than the hard armour that we all think works the best.
Oh, that is interesting. That goes against what my logic was telling me. What about gloves as well? Because they're incredibly important.
So gloves are incredibly important. And if we look at it with a glove, you're looking, when we put our hands down, we always put our palms down first. And if we're not, we're knocking the backs of our knuckles. So when you make a fist, it's the very top of your fist is where we tend to hit the ground the most. So having good abrasion resistant materials in the palms of the glove and having a solid knuckle protector. So most will have a carbon fiber or a foam filled plastic knuckle protector. Having that in a glove is really good, but also having a good wrist restraint. The last thing you want is for it to come off or to roll up at the wrist. So sometimes when you're sliding along the ground and your hand goes down, the glove can roll up over the top of your palm. And essentially, if you look at your hand, the bits that stick up in your palm are the bits that slide on the ground. So you need to have good abrasion protection in those locations.
Chris Hurren is with us, Chief Scientist at Motorcab. When it comes to protective clothing, do you think it gets enough attention, you know, in terms of preventing injury? So we know helmets and their importance, but that discussion around preventative clothing, because I know some people listening will be thinking, well, just don't ride a bike. They are inherently more dangerous than being in a car.
So motorcycles are more dangerous than being in a car because you don't have that protective shell around you. However, it's far safer to ride a motorbike now than what it was 10 years ago. Protective gear is definitely a benefit. One of my colleagues, Dr. Liz DeRome, did a huge amount of work where she looked at people that crashed motorcycles in Canberra in 2008 and 2009. And she found that if you were wearing protective gear, you significantly reduced your risk of injury in a crash. And so gear really does do stuff. And having a good helmet, jacket, pants, gloves and shoes will make a big difference if something happens and you do happen to crash.
We on the text line.
Not crash, of course.
Yes. can you ask if airbag vests are worth the money? What are airbag vests?
So airbag vests have been starting to appear quite heavily in stores in the last 15 years. MotoGP riders wear them. We're not able to test them yet at the moment, but there is developments underway to look at how we test them as part of MotoCap. But there is some data coming out to show that they have a benefit in a crash. Now, an airbag vest is going to absorb impact energy in that chest region, and this is where most fatalities tend to happen. So if you're reducing that energy going into the chest, then there is a benefit. They won't stop all crash types from having a problem. So an example, if you're travelling in heavy traffic and someone pulls out in front of you, you're going to leave the bike in a Superman-style pose where you're going to go head first into the side of that vehicle. The neck compression that you'd get from that at 60 kilometres an hour or higher is likely to be a fatal neck compression, and an airbag jacket would have very little effect on that.
Chris Hurren, thank you so much for joining us. Really interesting conversation.
You're more than welcome, and thanks for having me, Kirsten.
Chris Harran there, Chief Scientist at Motorcap and Associate Professor in Textile Research at Deakin University. Coming up, we will head to Bell's Beach to find out the latest with the surfing there. Apparently, the conditions haven't been great for surfing. It's been hard to get a wave, but we'll find out what it's like in just a moment. You are listening to The Conversation Hour. Kirsten Diprose here with you, filling in for Rochelle Hunt. She'll be back next week. It is my last day here with you, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. So thank you for having me. Tomorrow there is Anzac Day coverage. We are talking about GPs and dental as well. Thank you for all of your text messages. Here are some more. We all know why dental is not part of Medicare. If it was, it couldn't be seen as a value add for private healthcare, but some of us can't afford to have that either. Another text, it's easy to see why the field of dentistry was resistant to inclusion in Medicare. They probably foresaw what has happened to general practice. Doctors inadequately paid and overworked and often consequently unable to practice medicine in a way that they find professionally and ethically acceptable. That's from Marianne. Thank you for your text messages. Let's head over to the beach now. The Rip Curl Pro Bell's Beach competition is going ahead. It's now in its 62nd year and it runs until Monday. And joining us right now to have a chat about how the local community is going down in Torquay is Sean Doherty. Sean is the editor of Surfing World and a beach commentator at the event. Hi, Sean.
Yeah, morning. How are you going?
Good, thanks. So what are the conditions like today? I understand that it was fairly quiet the last few days in terms of the waves, but then we've had some more winds of late.
Yeah, the winds have been a bit tricky the last week or so, but it's really an Indian summer down here at the moment. It's, you know, you generally associate bells at Easter with, you know, multiple layers of jumpers and wetsuits and whatever, but it's down here today, it's super warm. Yeah, conditions are really, they're kind of beautiful, actually. It's a small swell, probably 3 foot or so, but the contest is running. We'll probably run all day. But yeah, we've had a, you know, to get here, it's been a bit of a journey. We've got a 12-day waiting period to run about 4 days of surfing. So yeah, we're running a little bit behind schedule, but yeah, all looking good.
I always laugh when a surfer says that the conditions are looking really good because you guys will go out in, you know, the freezing cold and all sorts of crazy conditions. But that's good to hear that the surf is underway. So what do you anticipate today's highlights?
Yeah, okay. Well, we just wrapped up women's round of 16. So that's been running all morning over at Winky Pop. So we're not actually at Bell's today. We're just at the adjacent point break at Winky Pop, which is a couple hundred metres to the east. So the women ran all morning. Great, fun little waves over there. And we've just put the men out for their round of 32. So there's 16 heats of those. So we're aiming just to go all day. So we're running, as I said, a bit behind schedule. Monday's the last day of the waiting period. But the way we're rolling, the new swell coming tomorrow, so we're probably looking at probably a finish over the weekend at some point.
Sean, I understand you've actually lived in Torquay for around 15 years. What does it bring to the town itself? You know, does it really bring the community together?
Yeah, well, it definitely grows the community because it's you end up with half of Melbourne down here over the Easter weekend. And, of course, the you know, we've had this convergence of school holidays, then Easter holidays, and we're rolling into an Anzac Day long weekend as well. So I think there's plenty of people who've probably just seen that as an excuse to stay down here for a week or so. But it's great. You know, it's like, obviously, you know, you're heading into the winter months down here and they get a bit sleepy and everyone, you know, goes somewhere warmer. So this is really like the last, you know, the last window where everyone, you know, comes down from Melbourne and really gets amongst it. And it's a big party vibe over the weekend at Easter, obviously. It has been for a long time. The surfing can play a bit of a secondary role to that. But it is, you know, it's, everyone loves it. It's been part of the fabric of the place here since, as you said, you know, it's 62 years now. So it goes a long way back. It's the longest running tour event there is anywhere in the world. So, yeah, it's hard to tell where the town stops and the contest starts sometimes.
Sean Doherty is with us, editor of Surfing World, who is with us covering the Bell's Beach competition. I mean, it's not just the surfers these days who come to Torquay for the competition. Like, it's people who just want to be there for the atmosphere.
Yeah, true. I think it's a uniquely Victorian thing in a lot of ways. Like, you know, I've been around a lot of tour events in a lot of places around the world, and you get crowds there, but they're mostly kind of in crowds, if you know what I mean. They're people that know and love surfing. But the Melbourne crowd, I think they're a bit more broad-minded in terms of sport. You know, obviously it's a major sporting capital of, you know, the universe with everything. So not everyone who comes down here knows everything about it, but they really dig in and sit down the beach, and they'll sit down the beach at, you know, freezing conditions and kind of get their head around who's who and they know, you know, a few big names, but they don't know everyone, but they'll sit and watch the heats and they'll understand it and they get right into it. And it's kind of good in that way, you know, that it is a surf town down here, but it is pretty open to, you know, to crew who don't surf.
So for anyone who's thinking, oh, I might pop down this long weekend, what day is the one where you're going to see the most action?
Yeah, well, probably the way things look at the moment, probably going to get a final on Sunday. Someone will ring the bell, I think, at some point on Sunday. There's a new swell coming here tomorrow, which should give us enough waves to run right through. But I don't think you'll lose, you know, Saturday, Sunday, any time. You'll see plenty of surfing.
Sean Doherty, thank you so much, and enjoy the beautiful weather.
I will. Yes, I'm just about to run out into it now. So, yeah, enjoy your weekend.
Thank you. Sean is the editor of Surfing World and a beach commentator at the Bells Beach Competition. It's all happening at Torquay. You are listening to The Conversation Hour, and we have been talking about bulk billing and dentistry. A few more of your text messages. I work in a tertiary hospital in Melbourne. Around once a month, we get someone coming in with a life-threatening dental infection with such extreme swelling that their ability to breathe is threatened. They sometimes go on to needing ICU care, an extraordinary expense for the community. Furthermore, I know of a man needing a heart operation but can't have it until he finds the money to attend a dentist. The dentist ensures there is no active dental infection that could spread to the heart. Yes, a lot of messages today about why dentistry is not part of Medicare. Thank you for all of your calls. This has been The Conversation Hour. I'll catch you next time.